first scripture today comes from Genesis chapter 21, verses 8 to 21. The baby grew and was weaned. Abraham threw a big party on the day Isaac was weaned. One day, Sarah saw the son that Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham, poking fun at her son Isaac. She told Abraham, "Get rid of this slave woman and her son. No child of this slave is going to share inheritance with my son, Isaac." The matter gave great pain to Abraham. After all, Ishmael was also his son. But God spoke to Abraham, "Don't feel badly about the boy and your maid. Do whatever Sarah tells you. Your descendants will come through Isaac. Regarding your maid son, be assured that I'll also develop a great nation from him. He's your son too." Abraham got up early the next morning, got some food together and a canteen of water for Hagar, put them on her back, and sent her away with the child. She wandered off into the desert of Beersheba. When the water was gone, she left the child under a shrub and went off 50 yards or so. She said, "I can't watch my son die." As she sat, she broke into sobs. Meanwhile, God heard the boy crying. The angel of God called from heaven to Hagar, "What's wrong? Don't be afraid. God has heard the boy and knows the fix he's in. Up now, go get the boy, hold him tight. I'm going to make of him a great nation." Just then, God opened her eyes. She looked. She saw a well of water. She went to it and filled her canteen and gave the boy a long, cool drink. God was on the boy's side as he grew up. He lived out in the desert and became a skilled archer. He lived in the Paran wilderness, and his mother got him a wife from Egypt. The second scripture is Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 through 13. "Write this to Philadelphia, to the angel of the church. The holy, the true, David's key in his hand, opening doors no one can lock, locking doors no one can open, speaks, 'I see what you've done. Now see what I've done. I've opened a door before you that no one can slam shut. You don't have much strength, I know that. You used what you had to keep my word. You didn't deny me when times were rough. And watch as I take those who call themselves true believers, but are nothing of the kind, pretenders whose true membership is in the club of Satan. Watch as I strip off their pretensions and they are forced to acknowledge it's you that I've loved. Because you kept my word in passionate patience, I'll keep you safe in the time of testing that will soon be here and all over the earth, every man, woman, and child put to the test. I'm on my way. I'll be there soon. Keep a tight grip on what you have so no one distracts you and steals your crown. I'll make each conqueror a pillar in the sanctuary of my God, a permanent position of honor. Then I'll write names on you, the pillars, the name of my God, the name of God's city, the new Jerusalem coming out, down out of heaven, and my new name. Are your ears awake? Listen. Listen to the wind words, the Spirit blowing through the churches."
Scriptures trace the story of the people of Israel from their beginnings into and out of slavery in Egypt, into and out of wandering in the desert, into and out of nationhood and kingship, into and out of exile, and the diaspora that follows. This is the story of peoplehood into which Jesus and his earliest followers were born. It's one that non-Jews like us get adopted into. The story begins with Abram and Sarai, who miraculously have a son in their old age. The lineage of the people of Israel is traced through that son, Isaac, the child of promise. But one of the endearing and enduring parts of Scripture is that it also includes stories that don't fit so well into that main narrative. Some of them are even shameful, or at least a little embarrassing. The story in Genesis 21 about Hagar and Ishmael is one of those. Ishmael was the oldest son of Abraham, born through his slave woman Hagar. It was Sarah's idea to give Hagar to Abraham. Sarah was unable to have children, and so a son through Hagar would serve as her own, giving her husband an heir. And then when Sarah does conceive in her old age, she gives birth to Isaac. And she quickly feels a rivalry between her and Hagar, between her son and Hagar's son, Ishmael. Her solution is to have Abraham and send Hagar and Ishmael away so Isaac can get the family's full inheritance. Abraham gets a message from God, which says, essentially, when in doubt, listen to your wife. So he gives Hagar and his oldest son some bread and some water, and he sends them away into the desert, where they wander until they have nothing left. It must not have been a lot of bread and water. It's not a very flattering story to tell about your revered patriarch and matriarch. Hagar's unable to watch her son die. She sets him under a shrub and then she walks off the distance so she can't see this. And this is how Genesis describes what happens next. And as Hagar sat opposite Ishmael, she lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the boy, and the angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, "What troubles you, Hagar? Do not be afraid, for God has heard the voice of the boy where he is. Come, lift up the boy, and hold him fast with your hands, for I will make a great nation of him." And then she opens her eyes. She sees water, she gets the water, she gives it to her son, and not only did they survive, but they flourish in the wilderness. And as an origin story, this works on a couple different fronts. It portrays the God who is so closely identified with the children of Isaac as a God who sees and cares for the needs of those outside that particular lineage. More specifically, it's now a story that honors today's Muslims who trace their lineage through Ishmael. And it also humanizes the founding mother and father by telling a story in which they are, to put it kindly, not at their best. If Abraham and Sarah are saints, then there's hope for all of us. The last couple of years, we've tried something that I hope to continue for years to come. We used this first Sunday in November to highlight the story of one of our Anabaptist Mennonite forebearers. Halloween gets most of the press, but historically, the reason for the season is a little more substantive than pixie sticks and Kit Kats. Although Kit Kats are a highlight. The intergenerational neighborly sidewalk festival that is trick-or-treating on Hallow's Eve is a prelude to something quite profound. In the All Saints and All Souls observance that follows, we in the church remember the dead, especially those who touched us in life. We open ourselves to the possibility that even those from whom we are separated by many generations are somehow present, even Abraham and Hagar and Sarah. We consider the mystery that in God all are alive. And we're comfortable acknowledging this means different things to different ones of us. 2 years ago, we looked at the story of Anna Jans from the 16th century. She died a martyr in her early 30s, leaving behind a young son and a heart-wrenching letter she wrote to him while in her prison cell. Last year, we looked at Menno Simons, the man who put the minnow in Mennonite, shepherding the young Anabaptist movement towards sustainability and peacefulness. Anna and Menno are pillars of the faith. We remember them as heroes, perhaps even saints, although we don't use that language much. This year I want to take a different angle and tell a Hagar and Ishmael kind of story. As we've been talking about sanctuary over the last month, I've been mindful that most of the stories that I've told have been from the perspective of those providing sanctuary. Saintly. So today I want to tell an unflattering story. A story that, if it has been remembered at all, has been remembered with shame. A story in which we are not the heroes. A story in which we were not the providers of sanctuary, but the recipients. It's the story of Klaus F. and a wayward group of Mennonites who followed him. Interest in this has been revived in the last decade by a group who retraced the steps of these events, discovered new things, and thus offered new ways to see the story. So it's been called the Great Trek. And it takes place, starts in Russia, in about 1880. Mennonites had been invited to Russia about 100 years before that by Catherine the Great to occupy farmland recently captured and cleared by the Russian military. But now, these settlers were facing forced military conscription. Most of the Mennonite communities were responding by moving to the Americas. But there was a group of families and leaders who thought it was a mistake to go west. Their ancestors had always kept moving east to escape persecution, and they thought there was significance in going toward the rising sun. So from the Ukraine, 5 wagon trains, about 200 families, headed east. They kept going beyond the reach of the Russian Empire into Muslim-ruled territory in Central Asia. The trek would ultimately cover 2,000 miles and land them in Uzbekistan. They were unfamiliar with the land. Much of it was desert. And they faced incredible difficulties, as we might imagine. Eventually, they abandoned their wagons and mounted all that they had on camels to make it through the desert. They often relied on the knowledge of the Muslim leaders they encountered and the hospitality of the villages where they would stay for winters. 2 years into the trek, the largest wagon train settled and established 4 different villages. And those who kept traveling were driven by strong apocalyptic beliefs. One of the leaders in particular, Klaus F., believed that Christ's return to earth was imminent. He believed it was the mission of this community to travel to the site where Christ would return. They would present themselves as the bride and rule with Christ in the millennial kingdom. Klaus F. saw their community reflected in the imagery of the book of Revelation. He believed they were like the first century church in Philadelphia, one of those 7 churches addressed at the beginning of Revelation, a letter to the angel of the church of Philadelphia and 6 other churches. He often quoted the line from the letter to Philadelphia, "See, I have set before you an open door." Klaus F. believed the door was being opened for them to trek toward the place where they would meet Christ. They wandered in Uzbekistan for 4 years, looking for the proper site. Class had declared that March 8th, 1889 would be the day of the Lord's return. Well, we know how that turned out. When the day arrived, the community waited with great anticipation. When the day passed and nothing happened, F extended the time to 1891. Classic. Just two more years, and the end will come. The Mennonites settled in the region, and when Christ didn't return again, they continued to live there until fleeing Stalin's forces 50 years later. So that's the story. And up until recently, little more was known than this sketchy outline. Our unhero, Klaus F., has been remembered at best as the butt of a few jokes. He does have his own Facebook profile, where he occasionally makes comments about the end of the world. At worst, he's remembered shamefully, or just not remembered. Overall, he's been someone about whom we now say, I'm not with him. Someone who, like Abraham and Sarah and Hagar, represents a time when the tradition was to be kind, not at its best. Well, the reason this story is being reconsidered is that 10 years ago, a group of scholars, writers, filmmakers, and descendants of those involved retraced this story. They were looking for more details about what the trip was like and what maybe learned. Part of what made them especially interested was they felt there are aspects of the Great Trek that have particular relevance in our own setting. 10 years ago, and now, and even this past week. I had plans to tell this story well before a man born in Uzbekistan aimed his truck down a bike path in New York on Tuesday, killing 8. What this modern-day group of North American pilgrims to Uzbekistan discovered and experienced was rather remarkable. From diaries that had recently surfaced, they knew that one of the wagon trains set up camp for 9 months in a village called Sarabulik. These original German-Russian Mennonites were, of course, trying to escape notice from the Russians. And they were greeted and taken in by local Muslim leaders. 5 of the Mennonite families had been given sanctuary within the mosque courtyard. The locals had offered their mosque as a place of worship for the Mennonites. The Muslims would use it on their holy day, Friday. The Mennonites used it on Sunday. Several weddings and funerals were held in the mosque, and 21 youth were baptized. While the investigative tour group was exploring Sarabulik, they had a fresh encounter with the hospitality village. They met with the local imam, and he allowed them to pray and sing inside the mosque. They offered a gift, and he offered a blessing. One of the pilgrims, Jesse Nathan, wrote this: astounding as this experience feels, it fits with what we're discovering as we retrace. These peaceful Christians built friendships with Muslims. Muslims who, in turn, shepherded the Mennonites through difficulty. In exchange, Mennonites introduced tomatoes, potatoes, dairy cattle, butter, and cheese to Uzbekistan. As they kept traveling and retracing the steps of the trek, they continued to discover that not only were the Mennonites remembered in the region, but they were remembered with respect. In another of the villages, the imam still does the annual springtime blessing of the crops on the land where the Mennonites lived, because it was known to be fruitful land that they had cultivated. Most surprising was that the people of Uzbekistan had no associations with the Mennonites being a group getting ready for the end of the world. We know they were getting ready for the end of the world. But the way they related with their Muslim neighbors was one of making an investment in this world. These Mennonite guests and migrants are remembered by the local residents for their frugal economics, yet their generous wages that they gave to those who worked for them. One of the group participants, a direct descendant of Klaus Epp, felt her travels offered a reinterpretation of the open door. She commented that this history could provide an open door for thinking about how Christians and Muslims relate to each other across differences, and how mutual respect and neighborliness that these groups showed to each other 100 years ago could be a model for us. Maybe today it's enough to remember that a little over 100 years ago, a group of theologically misguided Mennonites were given sanctuary in Uzbekistan. It's a story in which we are not the heroes, in which God worked through Uzbek Muslims to welcome and shelter people in our little tribe, odd as we are, and thus create the conditions in which we can be mutual blessings to one another. In a time when the children of Ishmael and the children of Isaac continue to be suspicious of each other and commit acts of violence against each other, we can remember that we are all children of Abraham. There are times in our life when we have been friends and blessings to each other. We can believe that God has set before us an open door to live out the story of God's reconciling love that is meant for all people. Ultimately, that is our story.